Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the raising of the Palestinian flag at the United Nations today and the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's declaration at the UN that he was no longer bound by the Oslo Peace Accords, which is the basis of the two-state peace accord with Israel. Khaled El-Gindi, who previously was an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations in 2007, joins us to discuss whether this is an expression of frustration with the Israeli occupation and the stalled, if not fraudulent, peace talks, or whether this is serious and will mean an end to Palestinian security cooperation with Israel. Then we'll look into the capture of Afghanistan's third-largest city, Kunduz, by the Taliban in a humiliating blow to the government of Ashraf Ghani, which has forced the U.S. to rethink its military exit strategy and consider leaving a few thousand more American troops in Afghanistan beyond 2016. A leading expert on Afghanistan, Thomas Barfield, a professor of anthropology at Boston University and president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, joins us to explain the significance of this military defeat, which is a boost for the new Taliban leader, and how fragile the security situation is in the country after 14 years of U.S. and NATO military intervention. Then finally, we'll be joined in the studio by Ani Sonnenfeld, the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values, and Dr. Sheikh Maitham Al-Salman, a prominent Shia cleric and Islamic scholar. He's the author of Non-Muslims in the Eyes of Islam, and we will discuss the criticism being leveled at the Saudi ruling family over the handling of the crane crash and then the horrific stampede at the Hajj in Mecca that has the countries whose citizens died questioning the casualty figures and demanding the return of the body. We will also discuss the broader issue of Sharia law and its relationship to the tenets of Islam. And joining us now is Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And today at the United Nations, President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority declared that his people were no longer bound by mutual agreements with Israel, including the Oslo Peace Accords. He basically said that there was no reason that the Palestinians should remain faithful to these accords as long as Israel was not. And therefore, he said, quoting, "We cannot continue to be bound by these signed agreements with Israel, and Israel must assume fully all its responsibilities as an occupying power." What's the challenge there to Israel?
Well, that's the question. I mean, it's a very vague and conditional sort of statement. As you pointed out, he said, you know, so long as or as long as Israel isn't abiding, then we're not bound in that same way. So he's sort of saying, you know, we're just as committed as Israel is in practice to these agreements. And so he's not actually renouncing the agreements or abrogating them. He's just sort of making a statement of a fact in a way. But it's also a warning, I think, of what could be a consequence of you know, continued Israeli settlements and sort of non-seriousness about negotiating a two-state solution.
Well, of course, you have to put this at the backdrop of a lot of new strife, particularly on the Temple Mount or Al-Aqsa, where there have been this long festering issues are starting to explode. There's a general feeling or an understanding that there's tremendous frustration amongst the Palestinians and amongst the Palestinian Authority. So is he just letting off steam? Or, I mean, the real issue would come to a head if he dismantled the Palestinian authorities and ended the security coordination with Israel.
That's true. And I personally don't think he's prepared to take that drastic step right now. But he's sort of pointing in that direction. I think he's trying to draw attention of the United States and the international community, but especially Israel, which is, you, as many people know, has not placed the Palestinian issue as a very high priority. So he's trying to, Abbas is trying to put this on the international agenda and sort of do it in a provocative way by warning the Israelis and by extension the Americans of what could come next if people don't start paying attention to what's happening on the ground. And what's happening on the ground isn't just settlements and provocations at holy sites. It's also a great deal of popular discontent and anger by Palestinians toward their own leadership. And I, as you suggested, I think that is part of Abbas's motivation in doing this and in doing it in such a dramatic way.
So the fact that after he made his speech to the United Nations, there was a ceremonial raising of the Palestinian flag at the UN for the first time, again, you see this more in terms of symbolism as opposed to substance, although clearly it's a change.
It is a change. And, you know, right now, obviously the Palestinians in the mix, in the regional mix and the broader international context, they are the weakest party. And so, you know, they have to very often resort to symbolic gestures to show that they are taking, you know, show their people and the international community that they are serious and taking steps toward statehood, independence, and so on. But at the end of the day, you can only do so many symbolic gestures, and unless Palestinians start to see palpable changes on the ground, the leadership, I'm afraid, will continue to lose credibility as far as its domestic standing is concerned.
But in raising the flag at the UN, Abbas said, "In this historical moment, I say to my people everywhere, raise the flag of Palestinians very high because it is a symbol of our identity." And among the dignitaries gathered were the foreign ministers of Russia, France, Saudi Arabia, Prime Minister of Turkey, and Secretary General Ban Ki-moon of the UN. The U.S. apparently wasn't there.
Right, which isn't surprising since the U.S. actually actively fought the measure and tried to prevent the vote from happening and it from having the flag raised there. So that's not surprising. That's really been the pattern of American behavior since for the last 40 years or so. But in doing that, I mean, you know, we talked about symbolism. In this conflict in particular, symbolic gestures can be very, very important, both in the negative and in the positive sense. You know, the United States fought tooth and nail against the PLO, against the bid at the United Nations 3 years ago to get recognition as a non-member state. It would have been symbolic, and it was symbolic, but the United States fought it very, expended enormous political and diplomatic capital on fighting it. And the Israelis, for decades, have resisted references to Palestinians as Palestinians, refused to have the PLO present in the peace process, you know, up until, you know, relatively recently, in the early 90s. So symbolism is something that carries great weight to all parties in this conflict, and especially for Palestinians, because it is an assertion of their identity and their existence. You know, the Palestinians have this saying that to exist is to resist. And that speaks directly to many years of Israel denying even the existence of a Palestinian people, much less a Palestinian, you know, question, political aspirations, and so on. So I don't want to diminish the importance of symbolic gestures because they are very important, but only that, you know, at the end of the day, if they don't change people's reality, people will lose patience with them.
Well, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed the speech by Mahmoud Abbas at the UN as deceitful, and it encourages incitement and lawlessness in the Middle East. So is that, I mean, that's, it doesn't sound like he's impressed. He's trying to dismiss it. But on the other hand, isn't it calling out the situation, the fraudulent nature of this stalled and sterile and somewhat phony peace process? I mean, it's all about process. It's not about peace. Everybody's fed up with it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I also think it's not unusual for Netanyahu or for the sitting Israeli leader to criticize whatever statement a Palestinian leader makes, even if they are, you know, whether or not they're engaged in an actual peace process. So much harsher language has been used by Netanyahu against Abbas, and then several months later they would be in talks together. So, you know, that's politics, that's international diplomacy. You know, both leaders are speaking to their domestic constituencies. So it's not surprising. But, you know, the bigger point is the one that you said about this process being fraudulent. And I would go even further and say it's actually non-existent. There is no peace process to speak of. There is nothing, there's no negotiation process that can resolve the conflict. And there aren't even mechanisms for preventing violence, as we saw last year in Gaza, or in Jerusalem currently, or in the past. There is no process either to control the conflict or to manage it or to resolve it. The parties really are just at their sort of left to their own devices, which ultimately is just you know, plays into the power dynamics and Israel being far, far superior in terms of its military and political and economic power, is much more so than the Palestinians. So that is essentially what has brought the Palestinian president to the UN, is to try and rebalance the scales a little bit to show that he has leverage. Even with Israel, with all of its might, there are options, and he has certain, you know, something in his arsenal, so to speak. Whether he's actually prepared to use those pieces of leverage, I think, is an entirely different question, because, you know, Mahmoud Abbas's record so far, he's shown that he's been very reluctant to use what little leverage he does have. And when he uses it, he tends to do it in a very incremental and tactical way, as opposed to taking strategic steps.
Well, Khaled Al-Gindi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Khaled Al-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the capture of Afghanistan's third largest city, Kunduz, by the Taliban. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and is the co-author of Afghanistan, An Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And the Taliban taking the northern Afghan city of Kunduz, which is the third largest city in Afghanistan, is clearly a blow to the government. In fact, already in parliament, they're calling for Ghani's resignation, and the intelligence chief apparently is also being hauled over the coals. But the Taliban are attacking on all kinds of fronts, in the south and in Helmand as well. What's your sense of what the strategy is? Is this, obviously, this is a boost to the new Taliban leader, Mullah Mansur?
Yes, it is. And the big difference is that the other fighting has taken place in sort of the heartland of where the Taliban formed in Kandahar, areas that have majority Pashtun populations. The northern area is economically more prosperous, has a non-Pashtun majority, and was considered in general safer from insurgency in the south. So to have a city fall in the north really seems to have taken the government by surprise, and that may have been Mansour's aim, because it was probably no accident that the city was attacked on the one-year anniversary of Ashraf Ghani becoming president of Afghanistan.
And so what is the population, since it's close to Uzbekistan and Tajikistan?
Probably about 300,000 people.
But in terms of its makeup, you say that...
Probably about 25% Pashtuns, and probably maybe 30% Tajiks, 30% Uzbeks, with some smaller groups around. It's an ethnically mixed population. It was a prime cotton-growing region. It had been formerly swampland that was reclaimed in the 1920s and 30s, so many different settlers from parts of Afghanistan came there because it was actually a land of opportunity when they sort of drained the swamps, got rid of the malaria, and went into the cotton business.
But clearly, though, this was very much Northern Alliance territory going back before the U.S. invasion.
It was, but you have to remember that Kunduz was the last Taliban city to fall. It was the Taliban stronghold, perhaps because of all the northern provinces. It has, while it's not a majority, it may be 20-25%, as I said, the largest number of Pashtuns. And they were staunch supporters of the Taliban when they were there. So there were quite a number of people that surrendered when the Taliban fell, but had not necessarily lost their sympathy for them. And to some extent, it represents the failure of the Afghan government to provide decent governance and security in the area. The people in Kunduz have been complaining more than a year that the outer provinces, the outer districts of the provinces, were coming under Taliban influence or Taliban control, and Ashraf Ghani's government was doing nothing about it. So it comes as a surprise that they got to the center of the city, but for close to a year they had been putting pressure on it, and from the point of view of the locals who live there, they were getting very little response from Kabul. Meanwhile, in the south, the U.S. was helping the army defend this small desert town of Musokala, which in the Helmand, which is essentially a really remote part of Afghanistan, of little strategic value, putting all of their effort there and not really watching what was happening in a much more important part of the country. You have to realize one more thing, too. When Pakistan began attacking Waziristan and throwing out some groups that were there, many of the people that are involved in Kunduz are not just Afghan Taliban. You have Al-Qaeda, you have the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, and you probably have some new Islamic State guys. So it's not just the local guys there. It's they've received a boost over the past year of people that have been coming into the area who had formerly been in Pakistan.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies and the co-author of Afghanistan, An Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So when you talk about the Taliban still having the advantage of unconventional warfare and having captured a lot of conventional military equipment, they won't necessarily know what to do with it or be able to hide it. Of course, it would seem that the U.S. is involved in pretty much in conventional warfare, and NATO is bombing the positions that the Taliban have taken over. And I believe the Afghan government still has the airport, where there's also special forces units there who are also involved in the fighting. So when now there's talk of the U.S. military perhaps staying longer and leaving behind more troops beyond 2016, what's your sense then of whether bombing the Taliban and presumably there would be collateral damage with the civilian population? What's the how effective is that?
Well, probably the area around the airport is not an urban area. Mm-hmm. So, and if the Taliban are attacking in a conventional manner, you know, an airport area, then the U.S. and NATO, they're responding with aerial bombardment. It's probably, given where it is, less likely to involve too many civilians. The difficulty is they can't really use that air power or artillery or anything else trying to retake the city. So, you know, that, but it's unclear whether the Taliban is even thinking about trying to hold on to the city, or is this a demonstration of power? There's probably only a few thousand of them. I mean, so this probably demonstrates more the weakness of the Afghan government than the strength of the Taliban. Remember that in the south or in the east, the Taliban have the ability to retreat into Pakistan or be supplied from Pakistan. This is the other side of the Hindu Kush Mountains. They're pretty much on their own there. So while they have some local advantages, they also have some disadvantages. So this may well be much more of an attempt to embarrass the Ghani government, but also to shake people's confidence in it. And I think it's much more a psychological move than it is a military move.
Well, but it's probably working, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't sound to me like the Afghan military and police have a handle on things. I mean, is there...
No, they definitely don't. But in some ways, the question is, will they have a handle on it next month? If they put enough effort into it, they probably will. Remember, also north of the Hindu Kush, and just west of Kunduz is the city of Mazar Sharif. That is very strong Northern Alliance territory. That is not Taliban territory. Those guys could attempt to relieve Kunduz on their own. That's what Dostum did in 2001 to bring down the Taliban. The problem for the Ghani government is if local forces take on the fight rather than the national government, then that leads to the situation where proving the weakness of the national government, which is something that Ghani's really trying to build up. So he's sort of caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of if his national forces are not working well, mobilizing local forces, but that would be, essentially re-empowering some of the local power brokers in the north.
So that would be back to the warlord situation. But you're almost suggesting here that, one, the U.S. and NATO, in terms of military strategy, were wasting their focus on a small, strategically insignificant post down in the south near Pakistan. And in the north, there's a vacuum because they got rid of the warlord armies and relied on the national army. This is a picture that would indicate that well, it certainly doesn't indicate much progress from going back to again to before the U.S. invaded.
Well, when the U.S. invaded, the Taliban were in charge of everything, so it's an entirely different situation. But what it calls into question is the whole strategy of turning everything over to the Afghan national government and proclaiming that, oh, they're capable of taking care of all the security things so we can get out. In fact, the U.S. and NATO wanted to get out, so they declared the Afghan government to be capable. Actually, it's proven, particularly in the south and the east, much more capable than people thought. But they really kept their sort of eye off of the developing problems in the north, and that may well be partially because Ashraf Ghani is more interested in the Pashtun areas of the south and east. He's really pushed sort of a strong Pashtun nationalist Abdullah's line. His co-executive partner, Abdullah, is a Northern Alliance guy. So one of the problems that we've got, we have this coalition government, which is actually called a unity government but hasn't yet unified. They still don't have a defense minister. How can you fight a war when you don't have a defense minister? I mean, one of the lessons this should be for both of Abdullah and Ghani is you really need to, you know, to stop the internal disputes between the two factions and get your act together. And both sides, to some extent, are a little bit guilty of putting their parochial interests first.
Right, but well, you could ask the same question. How can you fight a war, and this would be directed at the U.S. and at the White House, how can you fight a war when you delude yourself that your ally, Pakistan, is helping you, when in fact Pakistan is continually stabbing the U.S. in the back? I mean, if any American parent lost a son in the Afghan war, I think you can hold the Pakistanis responsible. They harbor, they train, they supply the Taliban. They have done all along. They've allowed them sanctuary. It's true they've had an offensive against the Pakistan Taliban. But at this point, is there any indication that Pakistan is going to change its attitude and be cooperative instead of being duplicitous?
Not that I can see. Ashraf Ghani actually made an outreach to Pakistan, which is very politically unpopular in Afghanistan, trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. And yet in August, a huge truck bomb went off in Kabul, killing hundreds of civilians. And he had to go on television and say, well, my attempt at outreach has failed. And that's one of the problems. The other problem is the negotiations that Pakistan was helping to sponsor with the Taliban taking place in Pakistan broke down when it was announced that Mullah Omar was dead, and we had an internal struggle about who was going to rule the Taliban. But the biggest thing is I don't believe that there has been a change in Pakistan's overall belief that it can undermine and hopefully topple this government and get its former Taliban allies back in power. I don't believe that's actually possible. That's actually quite a difficult thing to achieve. But you can certainly create a huge amount of instability in Afghanistan. And I do believe the United States, from the very beginning, from 2001, totally underestimated Pakistan's duplicity in terms of this. And so, you know, we have no disagreement there.
Well, but going forward, is there any leverage on the part of the U.S.? First of all, you know, we often have delusional foreign policy because we like to think countries are the way we'd like them to be and imagine them to be rather than the way they really are. And I think that's, to some extent, is why we're having this delusion about, you know, the fighting the war against the Islamic State in Iraq as if Iraq is still a country. And I don't know whether there's been a real change at the top in terms of our attitudes about Pakistan, but there are some new options with the Iranians. I mean, if we were supplying Afghanistan via the Iranian Indian-built highway from the Indian Ocean up to Herat, that could change things enormously and work with the Iranians. Is there any chance that we could show, because obviously you can't work with the Russians in the north, and we've been completely taken to the cleaners by the Pakistanis. Is there any way that we can show some flexibility there? And I mean, I guess you can't necessarily expect a lot of change based upon the nuclear agreement with Iran, but at least it seems like a window is opening there.
Well, a window is opening, and even in 2001, Iran and the United States were fairly much in agreement on wanting to see the Taliban gone. Afghanistan happens to be one of the few areas where the United States and Iran have more in common than they have opposing one another. But it's also true in terms of looking at this, the Chinese have begun to take more of an interest, as is India, because they've realized as U.S. and NATO has withdrawn, this problem still remains in their backyard. And China has a huge amount of influence in Pakistan. The Chinese premier was just there talking about building this huge infrastructure across China, from China into Pakistan. That can't possibly take place if there's this much turmoil in Afghanistan. But also, this fighting in the north, people forget that, you know, on the other side of the Pamir sits western China, Xinjiang province, and the Chinese are absolutely paranoid about the fears of Islamic terrorism coming to their backyard. I think they may overestimate that possibility, but they can't be happy at all to see a kind of the problems that were in southern and eastern Afghanistan suddenly moving north of the Hindu Kush, because that's a little too close to their territory, I think, for their taste. And so what we may find is that while the United States' influence with Pakistan is getting smaller, although we always have a problem that probably the civilian government probably agrees with us, but the military doesn't, and the question of who's in charge of Pakistan. But we still fund Pakistan to an enormous degree, and one of the questions is, so how come we're doing this? But I think the larger term issue that may come into it is China's attitude on this. As long as the West was keeping the lid on what was happening in Afghanistan, it was not China's problem. But now I think the past year or so, they've really become much more active in trying to come to some kind of resolution in Afghanistan.
Well, just in the last minute, though, we are funding Pakistan because we're under the delusion that we need to keep Pakistan's nuclear weapons from falling in the hands of terrorists, and that they effectively blackmail us into giving us money, when in fact the Pakistan government, and particularly the military, its policy is to use terrorism as a state instrument. So it's a complete joke that they're using terrorism under the nuclear umbrella, and we're funding their nuclear umbrella on the basis that they won't let these weapons fall into the hands of terrorists. I mean, how deluded can we be?
It's fairly deluded as far as I'm concerned. It's very hard to, however, governments are very slow to change their minds. And the whole rationale for supporting Pakistan is a Cold War legacy. The United States' economic interest and political interest in India are much greater in the Cold War. India and the United States didn't get along. They get along much better now. India and China are the two great economic powers of Asia. Pakistan is practically bankrupt. But it seems to be very difficult to change a policy initiative, even one that is not to your benefit. But I think in the long run, I think the question needs to be asked just what kind of alliance is this, and if it isn't, why should we be funding it? And there are other powers, every other power other than Pakistan, including Iran, Central Asia, India, China, they all want to see stability in Afghanistan. The only neighboring country that is not interested in stability in Afghanistan is Pakistan. And the Afghans complain vociferously about this, and they have every reason to. There's a lot of problems within Afghanistan, but I do feel that the Afghans would probably be able to solve their own problems if there wasn't an external backer for the Taliban.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and is the co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined in the studio by Ani Sonnenfeld and Dr. Sheikh Maitham Al-Salman. We'll be looking into Saudi Arabia's mishandling of the stampede at the Hajj in Mecca and the broader issue of Sharia law.
از اول جلوه ها میکنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند I'm
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Annie Zonneveld, who is a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. And also in the studio is Dr. Sheikh Maitham Al-Salman, a prominent Shia cleric, Islamic scholar, and international speaker who works to bridge positive relationships between cultures and religions. He is the author of Non-Muslims in the Eyes of Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Annie Zonneveld and Dr. Sheikh Maitham Al-Salman.
Hi, Ian.
Hello, hello, Ian. How are you?
Well, it's lovely to have you both in the studio. And let me begin with you, Dr. Sheikh Maitham Al-Salman, because I wanted to get a sense of the outrage that's been expressed, for example, by the president of Iran at the United Nations, Rouhani, started his speech out condemning what happened at the Hajj and blaming the Saudi Arabians for incompetence. And most of all, he said there were thousands died, you know, which is very much against the figure that the Saudis keep putting out of 700. The Nigerians and others who suffered casualties have also said that the numbers are incorrect. You were at the Hajj. I don't know whether you witnessed what exactly happened, but you were there on that very day, were you not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think until today, we did not have a clear number of the victims which passed away during the Hajj. And this is why we've heard statements from the Indonesians, the Nigerians, the Iranians, who were asking for the government of Saudi Arabia to publish a clear report and to name the actual victims. Until today, it's unclear how many have passed away. But I think the biggest alarm in this is the incompetence within Saudi Arabia in managing millions from across the globe pouring into a limited number of kilometers within a few days to perform their pilgrimage. There's a clear absence of safety regulations. There's a clear absence of the ability to manage those millions. And there is clear favoritism practiced towards royals who come in to perform Hajj. And this clearly contradicts what the concept of Hajj, which is based on equality between all who wear the same clothes, who recite the same prayers, who head in the same direction. And this is not practiced, because when royals or officials head to the Holy House or head to Mina, there's clearly a lot of favoritism given to them, and negligence is practiced towards the other millions who are waiting for the opportunity to perform the Hajj. And this is a clear contradiction with the concept of Hajj. In Hajj, there is no royalty, but devotion and humility towards God. And this is why a lot of Muslims are unpleased with what happened. And this is not the first time. This is probably the third time this has happened. And probably it's driven by the same reasons, which is practicing favoritism towards some royals who attempt to perform Hajj and neglecting the other thousands, the millions who deserve to be safe in the right environment during Hajj.
And Annie, do you think that this does bring into question the very legitimacy of the Saudi Arabian royal family, the ruling regime, because they are the custodians of the holy shrines? That is their principal responsibility, is it not?
Yes, and finally, we are starting to hear a lot of grumbling and complaining by Muslim majority countries and Muslims, you know, from the Muslim world, which is very uncharacteristic, let's put it that way. There has been some calling for a boycott of the Hajj, a boycott of Saudi Arabia, whether it be their arms, their oil, and what have you. These are just your lay Muslim citizens really speaking up. This is not the Muslim majority countries, the governments, but the Muslim majority people are starting to speak up. And this is very uncharacteristic because Muslims in general have been very silent when it comes to condemnation of anything Saudi.
But isn't there the significance of the Hajj is that it's every Muslim's obligation to go once in their lifetime.
Yeah. If so you can afford it.
If they can afford it. But yes. What we're talking about, what, 1.7 billion people, isn't it?
1.5, 1.7. It keeps increasing.
Something like that. Whatever it is.
Every week.
If you do the math, amongst that number, if a certain percentage of that number have to show up every year, in order to fulfill their religious obligation. That's an awful lot of people, and that number is growing, surely.
Absolutely.
But there's a quota. You know, there's every Muslim majority country, or every country has a quota based on the number of Muslim population. And so it's not like you can just get a visa and go. You have to, you know, it's very filtered, it's very restricted. So every country has a particular number, percentage of Muslims only that can attend the Hajj during the Hajj season. So it is very limiting and very restrictive.
So do you think, Dr. Sheikh Maitham Al-Salman, that there will be improvements made, or is there just inherently a problem when you've got a royal family, literally one family runs Saudi Arabia? So if the royals disrupt it and cover up and nobody wants to take responsibility. Somebody even said that it was God's will, you know. So, I mean, at what point do we have some, adult supervision, shall we say?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, Muslims around the world deserve an apology from the Saudi government, because they're responsible for all the regulations. They're responsible for the safety of the millions pouring into Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj. Until today, there was no apology published by any official figure by the government regarding the hundreds or thousands which have passed away.
Yeah.
So this is the first point. The second point is Muslims need to get involved as well. I mean, until today, the Indonesian government wants to see the bodies of the victims who passed away. And they're being denied that this basic right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which just shows that there's a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of absence of transparency with regards to what happened in Mina. And that's why until today, we don't have a clear picture. I was in Mina in the same day. And all I could hear was the sirens. But we had no idea what was happening because we were millions, obviously, on the same day. And Saudi Arabia until today has not issued a clear report. I think what Muslims around the universe want right now is a clear message of apology and guarantees that this will not happen in the future, and a clear report with the names, nationalities of all the victims who passed away.
And it sounds like if you were there, you were in effect, by the grace of God, you survived.
Absolutely. I passed by the hospital where all the victims were taken, and you could sense in the air, you could sense the level of intensity, the fear within the eyes of those who are performing Hajj. And year after year, I feel that since I've been to Hajj for 17 times, so I'm quite the guru.
You've
when it comes.
Well,
when
it comes.
So the background on that, he leads a congregation. Too.
Yeah.
It's not because he goes there to get a kick,
yes,
right?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Right.
So there's
right.
a responsibility for why he's there.
Well, let me again remind the audience that I'm speaking with Annie Zonneveld, who is a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. And also joining us in the studio is Dr. Sheikh Maitham Al-Salman, a prominent Shia cleric, Islamic scholar, and international speaker who works to bridge positive relations between cultures and religions, and he's the author of Non-Muslims in the Eyes of Islam. Now, We want to talk about Sharia law, and of course, we're having both of you will be at the Yousli Hammer Forum tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. That's October the 1st in Westwood. I'll be moderating a discussion with you both. But let's start with the nexus between, or the association of these two words, Islam and terror. And yesterday at the UN, President Obama hosted a meeting. Today, the Russians had their meeting because they're the president of the Security Council at the moment. So, you know, it's not even the U.S. and Russia can't agree on a definition. The Indian Prime Minister castigated the UN after 70 years. There's no definition of what terrorism is. So what was going on at that meeting yesterday? It was convened. What's your sense of the idea that Obama's takeaway line that the press picked up on was that there's no military solution, that we have to change hearts and minds, which unfortunately has echoes of Vietnam?
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I think we've been conveying this message since September 11th. The United States and other influential international players in the war against terrorism have been relying on governments to counter the growth of violent extremism, to counter the incitement of hatred that leads to mass atrocities. However, today, if we compare the level of terrorism, the growth in religious hostility, the growth in radicalization across the Middle East in the last 10 to 15 years, we're going to see a tremendous rise. That is because governments, international powers, have not been relying and partnering with the right players in countering violent extremism. What I believe should be the focus right now, since the international community has reached a conclusion that military action is not the solution. Even if you have military action against Boko Haram in Nigeria, or against ISIL, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, that's not the solution. Because ISIS, ISIL, Boko Haram, Shabab al-Mujahideen, and other terrorist groups are offsprings of takfirism. The concept of takfirism has three levels. A kafir is basically a non-believer. So those who practice takfirism have three levels. The first level is a non-believer doesn't deserve social, economic rights. The second level is a non-believer doesn't deserve the right to live. It's unfortunate that there is a growth in takfirism within the Middle East in the last few years. And I'm very sorry to say that the privileges given by non-democratic governments to some religious institutions which try to practice takfirism, acknowledge takfirism, accept takfirism, or even broadcast takfirism is one of the major reasons. And some of these countries are partnering with the United States in the war against terrorism.
So, can you substitute, or what's the difference between takfirism and Wahhabism?
Okay.
Well, if I can say something really quick, not takfirism is not just the Middle East issue, because it's everywhere, including some Americans and Muslims in the West and even in Southeast Asia and Malaysia, which is where I come from. So this ideology of takfirism is really rooted in this intolerant theology, which comes from Wahhabism, which has become the norm. Unfortunately. And so this is what has dictated. I mean, I'm looked upon, and many of the Muslims in the progressive community are also accused of being non-believers as well, don't deserve to live. But the level of from which we're talking about policy here, the fact that the governments are the ones that are getting the funding, the very governments that are perpetuating this takfirism, intolerant hate, theology, they're the ones that the United States is partnering with, is the problem. Now, we hear all this time, for however 2 years or so now, that military is not the solution with the rise of ISIL, and that there should be, Obama, I think, verbatim said that there needs to be an alternative ideology that trumps, that is enlightened, that is, you know, that trumps this ISIL ideology. But, well, where's the money? And whatever money is, it's going into the wrong pockets. And that is the problem. And I don't understand how the government cannot see this. And I don't understand why, as a grassroots organization, as an organization that's been the alternative to ISIL for in the context of progressive Islam, in inclusive interpretation of Islam worldview, right? Why are those Muslims on the ground with this inclusive worldview not the ones the government is supporting?
Well, but I've always had that question since this so-called war on terror began after 9/11. It always struck me that we were basically, and even by starting off and using the word, calling them jihadis, which is dignifying them. You're actually, yeah, you know, giving them a religious kind of connotation when in fact they're criminals. I mean, the definitions were never correct in the first place. And if we really had an enlightened approach as opposed to the Bush-Cheney approach, which unfortunately is still been continuing, that we would surely should recognize that in our country, our first line of defense against so-called extremist Islam are the very Islamic communities we have here in the United, yeah, States. They're the people we should be empowering,
yeah,
you know, because I as a Christian or somebody as a Jew can't dissuade,
yeah,
a Muslim who's going to take this path towards radicalism.
Yeah, you're a takfir anyway. You're a raven.
but I could subcontract it out to you, and you'd do a better job, right?
I should hope so, yeah.
I completely agree. I feel that, and I think that religious leaders, non-governmental players, civil society are better placed, especially within the Middle East, to deal with the growth of takfirism and the growth of violent extremism. Governments within the region, when they intervene, sometimes that forms some kind of an intimidation. Even within the West, I've read recently a report about Sweden whereby an imam was inciting hatred against non-Muslims. And when the government wanted to get involved, Muslims got very much intimidated. However, when they went through civil society organizations, moderate religious leaders, they were much more successful. So what governments need to keep in mind is that moderate imams, non-governmental players, civil society are on the front line in countering violent extremism. And it's not only governments. Governments, even if they were willing to play a role in, right, actually countering the growth of extremism, they're not as effective as non-governmental players.
Right, but the problem we have here in the United States is that we're insulting and denigrating with Islamophobia, with all these preemptive laws being passed against Sharia law in Oklahoma and Kansas and all these state houses, all this imaginary stuff. Do you realize that the number two bestseller on the New York Times nonfiction list this week is a book by Glenn Beck, who's you probably don't know him, Sheikh, but he's a total ignoramus, you know, and it's his version of Islam, and it's all about Islamophobia. So here we are, actually, instead of recruiting our own Muslim communities in this country to be on the front line of this so-called fight against terrorism, we're alienating them. It's crazy.
But even like in Malaysia, the government is the one that is perpetuating the ideology of intolerance. And it's a multi-religious, multicultural country. And, you know, we have Muslims for Progressive Values on the ground. We have an office there. And it's a struggle because you are basically fighting what the government is propagating. It's like...
But he's a crook too, that guy.
Najib.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is he doing... Is he... Using that old trick that
crooks
do. Of course,
use religion, yeah.
You lose religion to distract people from how much money you're stealing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, that's an old story, isn't it?
Yeah. But the problem is the Malays, not all, obviously, the Muslims in Malaysia are actually buying into it, right? And so now they're ramping, they've got this nationalistic, racist mixed in with religion, Islam. It's really problematic, but that's the trajectory there.
Well, since we're going to be talking about Sharia law tomorrow evening at the UCLA Hema Forum at 7:30 p.m. in Westwood, I'll be moderating the discussion with our two guests here today. Tell me, is it possible that we don't? Well, I know we don't know what Sharia law is, but does it really exist? Is it a real concept?
All right. We need to differentiate between two things. Mm-hmm. Between what Sharia is and what our understanding of Sharia is. The problem is that when you generalize and say, okay, this is what Sharia is, we have 100 readings, probably more, of what Sharia actually is. Because the reading of the rules and regulations which were set by the Quran is greatly influenced by your social environment, by your cultural preferences, by your political background, by many other aspects. And therefore, I believe it's very hard, not only for non-Muslims, but for Muslims to decide and say, okay, this is exactly 100% what Sharia is. This is the path of God towards creating internal and social peace and stability. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to do that. And I think a lot of focus is given to the negative example. Unfortunately, today, 80 to 90% of suicide bombers are Muslims. Mm-hmm.
And a good percentage of them are Saudis, right?
Absolutely. And this just shows that just relying on governmental players or governments encountering extremism is not the solution. Saudi Arabia and other GCC states, they only had a number of scores of suicide bombers. Today, we have hundreds and thousands of suicide bombers. And those who are ready, which clearly shows that there is a rise in religious hostility in the region. So unfortunately, a lot of media highlights what's happening and phrases it as Sharia. This is not Sharia. This is a reading of what Sharia is.
And I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I'm grateful to have this conversation with Ani Zonnefeld, a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and founder of, and president of Muslims for Progressive Values, and Dr. Sheikh Mehtham Al-Salman, a prominent Shia cleric and Islamic scholar and the author of Non-Muslims in the Eyes of Islam.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.